Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. Sorry for the brief delay, but just wanted to start the show off by we usually start off with the show's intro, and obviously today we're not starting off with the show's intro because in honor of the life, legacy, and work of Nelson Mandela, we want to open up by offering our deep condolences to Nelson Mandela's family, as well as the people of Zania, of South Africa, as they mourn the loss of one of their great freedom fighters. And we know that South Africa has a long, long list of freedom fighters, you know, like the likes of Chris Hani, the likes of Robert Sobukwe. We can go on and on. Steve Biko, of course, great freedom fighters and organizations like SASO and the Black Consciousness Movement, PAC, you know. So we wanted to really kind of start the show off by playing this clip and then giving just a little bit of perspective, our perspective on things, because we certainly don't want to contribute to the mental delusion that is caused by the Western corporate media, as these hypocrites as well as politicians put out information about Nelson Mandela. They're now genuflecting and as if they gave a damn about his life, about the struggle that he and so many others were a part of, and quite frankly, the struggle that so many South Africans find themselves in the midst of today. Because even though a physical apartheid has ended, there's no more past laws and so forth in South Africa. However, South Africa is embroiled, is stuck in a deep and dirty economic apartheid that the Western corporate media and the likes of President Obama are not saying a damn thing about. And so I want to play this clip, and then we'll come back, and then we'll get to a really important piece from Netford Freeman, who just recently came back from Cuba. But I want to play this and then, you know, kind of close out, you know, our thoughts. Well, not close out our thoughts, but bring them to a head so that we can move forward with an action-packed show, full with information and extremely terrific guest that we have lined up today, and that's Norman Richmond. So without further ado, I want to play this clip, and then we'll see you back in a couple minutes.
Had it not been for the Cuban presence in Africa, and in particular in Angola, the history of Africa would have never been what it is now. One of the greatest friends that Cuba has is Nelson Mandela, and his appreciation for what the Cuban people did, and Fidel Castro. But I think if you don't understand that history, then you'll never really understand the enormous success and the importance of the Cuban Revolution.
And that is very, very important. Very important. That was Harry Belafonte. And, you know, I couldn't agree more. Had it not been, so people, as you reflect on the life of Nelson Mandela, please, you must, because the corporate media is not going to tell you this. The corporate media is not going to tell you who helped liberate much of Southern Africa, including South Africa. As we know, Southern Africa is a big region, you know, with several different countries. South Africa just happens to be one of those countries. The corporate media is not going to mention that, because the corporate media supports the brutal blockade of Cuba that has cost the Cuban government and its people well over $100 billion, with a B, well over $100 billion since this blockade has been put. It's not an embargo. It is a blockade. As Fidel Castro and many Cubans say, it should appropriately be called a blockade, not an embargo. So as this embargo continues to remain intact, all right, you remember who helped free Nelson Mandela. who the U.S. corporate media is not talking about and is not going to tell you about, who Barack Obama is not going to talk to you about. It is the likes of Fidel Castro, the likes of Che Guevara, and so many others. Those people, the nation of Cuba, got behind, you know, the liberation of Southern Africa, as well as places like Algeria and Guinea-Bissau, where they sent in 325,000+ troops into Southern Africa, into places like Angola, the legendary Battle of Quito Carnival. And if it was not for the Cubans and their internationalism coming to the aid of their African brothers and sisters, we don't know when Mandela might have been free. We have no idea when he might have been freed. We have no idea. And therefore, we have no idea when apartheid might have ended. It wouldn't have been, I'm quite certain it wouldn't have been 1994. Okay? I'm quite certain it wouldn't have been in 1994. And that's why the first country that Mandela went to upon leaving the African continent, the first country he went to outside of the African continent was Cuba, where he was greeted by Fidel Castro and hundreds of thousands of people in Havana, where he got on stage and he thanked them. He thanked Fidel Castro and the Cuban people for what they did, for what they did. And then when Castro went to the continent of Africa, when he was going to South Africa, he stopped in Namibia on the way there, was greeted by Sam Nujoma, who was the leader of SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization, and he thanked them. And then the people of South Africa thanked Castro when he arrived there. Remember that. Remember that, okay? And so when you listen there and you get all teary-eyed, oh, Obama does some really nice things about Mandela, what a nice man. No, he's not. When Obama reflects and he says that, when he says things like, for instance, yesterday he said, you know, he talks about how he reminisced how he was inspired by Nelson Mandela. Well, inspired by what, man? What were you inspired by that Nelson Mandela did? I don't remember Mandela killing, you know, countless civilians by way of drones. I don't remember Mandela invading, you know, and waging war on Libya based on a pack of lies and then contributing to the deaths of 52,000+ Libyans. I don't remember that. I don't remember Mandela having a program of recolonization called Africa and him expanding it to 35 nations in the continent like Obama's done. I don't remember those. So what are you inspired by? 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 And the reason Obama and the corporate media can get away with this, whether it's MSNBC and those bunch of friggin' blowhard hypocrites on Morning Joe or the white supremacists on Fox News, as long as Americans continue to be obsequious and mentally and media illiterate, And just foolish and dumbed down, they will continue, because their words, their lies, and their hypocrisy, the lifeblood of their lies and hypocrisy, believe it or not, is the foolishness of countless American citizens and residents. So you stop getting your narratives and stop getting your news and your primary news and information from the corporate media. And then that will be the first step to you regaining the liberation of your mind. So as Mandela was liberated, in honor of him, why don't you liberate your minds and tear it away from the mainstream lies that are put out by the corporate media, the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, and the like. And so with that being said, I'm joined in studio by Tim Bodoff Lynchin. Tim, just, you know, a couple words about, you know, in reflection of Mandela and what, you know, this whole situation, you know, means to you in terms of like his life, his legacy, and unfortunately, his passing after 95 years on this planet. But then even in broader perspective, what it means in the continued quest for justice. And I put this also. I also can mention that Obama and the rest of these friggin' fools are a bunch of hypocrites, because Mandela was fighting what? Apartheid, right? Mandela and so many other folks, Oliver Tambo, were fighting apartheid. Well, what does Obama support in Israel? He supports apartheid. That is apartheid. And Desmond Tutu himself, Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, knows a little thing about apartheid, goes to to Palestine and says, this looks just like the apartheid that we faced, and in some instances, even worse. Tim Bonoff Lynchin.
Thank you, Solomon. I couldn't agree more that the fight against apartheid is just as current today as it was during the lifetime of Nelson Mandela. And I believe what his death means to me is basically a wake-up call of inspiration to continue his legacy and his work. Because just as Mandela put his life on the line for the struggle and the liberation and self-determination of African people, his opponents do too and continue to till this day. So if we just rest and stay complacent with his and put his achievements on a pedestal without trying to continue them and continue to use strategies to fight that oppressive system that continues till this day, then his work will be in vain because eventually his opponents will nullify those accomplishments if they are not continually defended and expanded. So to me, his death really is an inspiring call to action to continue his life's work and his legacy.
Thank you. And so without further ado, we're going to play a piece. One of our comrades, a friend of Your World News, Netfer Freeman, just got back from Cuba, attended the 9th colloquium and conference on the Cuban Five. So this is a radio piece that was put together by Netfer while he was in Cuba. And so we're going to play this, and then as soon as it's done, we're going to be joined by Norman Richmond from Toronto, Canada, who is going to talk to us about the history of black music in the United States.
Fidel Castro was a great man, and everyone in the world recognizes that. We have said of Fidel Castro, and it's true, President Secretary says that at any given moment, the best traditions of any people may be represented by all of them, a majority of them, a minority of them, or one of them. And if Fidel Castro is the only human being that represents humanity at its best, humanity will never be diminished one iota. Fidel Castro is a man of great stature and great comprehension, a little island like Cuba. He is himself leaped beyond this island of Cuba. He is known everywhere throughout the world, and he's respected everywhere throughout the world, except by capitalist digs, everywhere. America has no right to talk to Cuba. Cuba can teach America so many things. America says that it's one of the richest countries in the world, and even demeans Cuba because it's one of the poorest. Yet the conditions of health of a child in Cuba is better than the conditions of health of any child in America. From the child that child is born until it dies, it will have a doctor in its community that will monitor every movement it makes, free of charge. Because Fidel Castro understands that the most important thing in a society is the quantity and quality of the people and their rising level of consciousness, that they have, first of all, a responsibility to other Cubans before they have a responsibility to themselves. America is the exact opposite. Doctors to Africa than America and all of Western Europe together have sent. We're not even talking about freedom fighters. When I first went to Africa in the 1960s, I was shocked. Among all the liberation movements, PAIGC and Guinea-Bissau, Frelimo, MPLA, among all of them, I found Cuban combatants there teaching them, even sometimes fighting and dying with them. Fidel Castro, we have to respect him. We are Pan-Africanists, and Fidel Castro is a Pan-Africanist of the highest order. When Angola was bleeding and the racist pigs in South Africa invaded Angola, Fidel Castro sent the sons and daughters of Africa, sent those Cubans there whose bloodstream has Africa tied to it, to go and defend Africa, to go and defend Africa's dignity. Fidel Castro, that's why the African community here, we instinctively love him. When Fidel Castro came to America at the United Nations, he came to live at the Theresa Hotel in Harlem. No other president has ever done that. That's the honor he paid to us. And he paid us that honor because we instinctively supported him. We always instinctively support justice. And we know that Fidel Castro is undergoing a just struggle, a struggle for independence, a struggle to be not under the hegemony of American imperialism like all the other puppets in the Caribbean. When America says jump, they say how high. Fidel Castro is concerned of one thing, making sure that the national resources of his country serve the priority of the well-being of his people. Go to these other countries. They sell whatever they have. As a matter of fact, their leaders are sorry, slavery is over. Tourism is properly controlled by the Cuban Communist Party. Properly controlled. I mean, they're making experiments with it, but they themselves are in the position of controlling and has within a limited aspect because at this point it's only experiments. Of course, U.S. capitalism is hoping that through this this will happen, but it's just a fight always. And you go into a ring, you fight, you're convinced you will win, the enemy is convinced they will win. We will see. But I think the attack here, the political attack, is what I want to speak of. Under this political attack, it appears that because the people in Cuba are poor and they have nothing to eat, that they'll be disgruntled. Vietnam defeated America. Defeated America. And I was in North Vietnam. I had one of the greatest honors of my life. I had lunch with Ho Chi Minh in North Vietnam when American planes were bombing North Vietnam. One of the greatest honors of my life. And the Vietnamese who fought America, they fought America, and every Vietnamese soldier had not one bowl of rice a day. That was their ration. And they whooped America. What does not having food have to do with a fight when you're down? Matter of fact, the poorer you are, the more determined you are in the struggle. So if America keeps thinking that because now the Cubans will only have one bowl of rice, the Vietnamese defeated them on one bowl of rice. The Cubans defeat them on half a bowl.
This is NetBa, and I'm with Alicia Arapco, and we just did over 13-hour bus ride from Havana to Holguin, Cuba, and we're here for a colloquium. Alicia, tell us what's going to happen in the next 5 days.
Well, there are different activities that are going to happen, and really a lot of different things. It's going to be a lot of activities with the people of Holguin. The colloquium is about gathering people from all over the world and many people from Cuba to talk about what the movement in solidarity with the Five has done in the last year and what else we're going to do next year. And this is a very special colloquium because for the first time we have the presence of one of the Cuban Five who was free after serving his entire sentence, and he is here. He's going to be here with us tomorrow. It's a lot of different activities. It's going to be tomorrow an opening plenary. It's going to be visiting the Committees of Defense of the Revolution. It will be cultural events, all sort of different things, and participation of delegates from all over the world.
Thank you.
Se unifica con más fuerza, la batalla continúa hasta luchar y vencer. Y ahora el mundo fía su mirada hacia Cuba, tierra brava de Raúl y de Fidel. Combatiendo la injusticia
cantaré mis canciones al destino y con mi voz haré temblar la muerte.
This is Netfa Freeman. I have the honor and privilege of speaking with Rene Gonzalez, who did 13 years in U.S. prison. He's one of the Cuban Five, the first to be free from U.S. prison. He served the time, the full sentence, and soon to be released is Fernando Gonzalez in February. And so we look forward to that. However, this is not justice. Justice would for them to never have gone to prison in the first place, and then for other brothers, Geraldo Hernandez and Ramon Lavagnino and Antonio Guerrera, to be free unconditionally. So we still have to work for that. And I just want to ask you, brother, a few questions to help our listeners understand things more and hopefully be fortified with information that will help them. I want to say it's an honor. Thank you for talking to me with this interview. The first is, I understand I'm reading Stephen Kimber's book right now. And you were born in the U.S. Your family, your parents moved to the U.S. before the Cuban Revolution and then ended up moving back afterwards. But so the first question is really, what knowledge, I guess, and information might your parents have imparted on you or shared with you that gave you your political consciousness and your commitment to the Cuban Revolution? And particularly if you can share how it might have influenced your choice to fight in Angola. You were one of those that disturbed in Angola against apartheid South Africa to help Angola get its independence.
Well, I want to start by advising everybody to read Kimber's book.
Stephen Kimber, in his new book, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five.
In my opinion, he's the best thing that's been written on the case. He did a great research, and he wrote a book which is tied to the facts, to the most elemental things. So it's a good way to get acquainted with a case which, on the other side, is a very complex case. Now, you say my parents, they are working class Cubans who, by different ways, ended up in the U.S. in the 50s. They met there. And I was born in 1956. And then in 1959, it came the Cuban Revolution. And since the beginning of the revolution, they felt sympathy for the goals and the purpose of the revolutionary process. So they decided to come on 1961. It was an interesting time to be in Cuba. It was a time of struggle. The island was already under the blockade, and there was a lot of terrorism imposed on Cuba. Back then I was 5 years old, but my first memories are tied also to the violence that was imposed on us by bombings, shootings at places. I remember the counter-revolutionaries who went to the mountains, and how the U.S., the CIA would come and drop weapons for them there. So I was born in that environment, which is an environment that makes you grow, politically speaking.
Aunque bloqueen mi país,
no, no, no.
Oye, mi fuerza no falla,
no, 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 no.
Con una cinta amarilla yo seguiré en la batalla.
Esta canción está bueno ya, de bloqueo genocida, contra Cuba nuestra patria querida, los cubanos seguimos para adelante, con Raúl y nuestro comandante.
Bueno, mi gente, todo el mundo con la mano para arriba, ahí nada más, y diciendo, Cuba no se rinde, y lo que dice, Cuba no se rinde.
Bicycle marathon in support of the Cuban Five in Holguín. It's hundreds and hundreds of people passing by on bikes, even some people jogging. and people are gathered along the street, cheering them on, singing, clapping. Alicia, do you want to describe what's happening?
Well, it's just there are different things going on at the same time, and right now in the street there is a marathon. Some people are in bicycles, a lot of people are in bicycles, and as they go by, people cheer the bicycles. There are like very young people, older people, women with children in their bicycles. It's very exciting.
Desde el cono sur y venías desde antes con el amor al mundo bien adentro. Una estrella que te puso aquí y te hizo de este pueblo de gratitud. Nacieron muchos hombres que igual que tú no querían que te fueras y son otros desde entonces. Después de tanto tiempo y tanta tempestad, seguimos para siempre, es el camino largo, largo, por donde tú vas, por donde tú vas. El fin del siglo anuncia una vieja verdad, los buenos y los malos tiempos hacen parte de la realidad, de la realidad.
Yo sabía bien desde aquella vez que ibas a crecer, que ibas a quedar, porque la fe no ha matado a la utopía, porque tu amor es eterno y la gente que te ama no te olvida. Lo sabías bien desde aquella vez que ibas a crecer, que ibas a quedar, porque la fe no ha matado a la utopía, porque tu espíritu es humilde y la gente que te ama no te olvida. Después de tanto tiempo y tanta tempestad, seguimos para siempre, es el camino largo, largo, por donde tú vas, por donde tú vas. El fin del siglo anuncia una vieja verdad, los tiempos hacen una parte de la realidad, de la realidad. Son los sueños todavía que dicen de la gente como un imán que nos une cada día. No se trata de molino, no se trata de un bigote, algo se templa en el alma de los hombres, una virtud que se eleva por encima de los títulos sin nombre. Después de tanto tiempo y tanta tempestad, seguimos para siempre, es el camino largo, largo, por donde tú vas, por donde tú vas. El fin del siglo anuncia una vieja verdad, los buenos y los malos tiempos hacen una parte de la realidad, de la realidad.
Vamos. Bala Kaigama de Nigeria. Por favor.
¡Viva! ¡Viva África!
¡Viva!
¡Viva Cuba!
¡Viva!
My brothers and sisters, I bring you fraternal greetings. I am Comrade Boboi Bala Kaigama, the President of the Trade Union Congress of Nigeria, the second largest trade union in Nigeria and Africa. Comrades, we Nigerian delegation took a flight of 23 hours to Havana to come and solidarize with Cubans and the struggle to emancipate the Cuban part. First, I want to commend the effort of the organizers of this 9 colloquium. I want to commend the government of Cuba. I want to commend the international community for the struggle against oppression, for the struggle against the imperialists of this world. We want you to understand that we in Nigeria, at one time or the other, because of our struggle to emancipate our brothers, sisters in the African region, particularly the South African countries, we were at one point termed member of a frontline state. We in that spirit strongly believe that we should identify with the Cuban fight. We should identify with the international community for the struggle for the emancipation and for the freedom of the Cuban fight. We from Nigeria, I want to assure this colloquium that we have come, we have seen Cuba, we have seen and shared experiences with other countries of the world. We are going back to Nigeria with these experiences. We are going back to Nigeria to make sure we deliver the message of freedom for Cuban Five, freedom for the emancipation of the oppressed people of the world, freedom for the emancipation of the entire nation of the world.
Okay, this is Nefa. I'm speaking with Comrade Boboi Bala Kaigama, and he is the president of the Trade Union Congress of Nigeria, and we just heard his presentation here at the colloquium in Holguín, Cuba. Brother, thank you for joining me. I want to just ask you, if you were to convert your address to the Cuban people here, and you were to focus it at the people in the United States and also the power of the U.S. government, maybe President Obama, who have the power to free the Cuban Five, how would you address, what would your message be?
My message would be, Obama, he said he can. We are calling on him to do it. Give us the Cuban Five. We know Cubans have a history of revolution, have a history of struggle against imperialism, and we Nigerians, we back Cuba 100%. So our call is for Obama to do the can and release the Cuban Five. That's our call.
Mm-hmm. And then for the U.S. people who really have the responsibility to put the most pressure on the U.S. government.
Yeah, we appeal to the U.S. Congress, U.S. general public, to put more pressure on President Obama to ensure that the Cuban Five are released in no distant future. We trust the United Nations general public of uprightness when it comes to issues of human rights. We trust the United Nations, the U.S. Community when it comes to issues of human rights. We trust them when it comes to issues of fight against imperialism. This is a straight case of imperialism. So we urge the United States public to ensure that they prevail on their government to release the Cuban Five. What people don't know is that Nigerians, and particularly in general Africans, have benefited immensely from the educational policies of Cuba, from the medical health policies of Cuba. In Nigeria today, we have groups of Cuban doctors who go to Nigeria urban centers and rural areas to deliver free medical services. You have Cuban engineers who go to Nigeria rural areas to deliver free infrastructural services. You have Cuban educators who go to Nigeria to deliver free education. So the impact of the Cuban administration on Africa is very, very immense. And that is why Africans will continue to identify with Cubans any day, anytime.
Okay, I'm speaking with Sean Clancy. He's with the International Committee Ireland, representing Ireland. And you're here at the colloquium, the ninth colloquium, to free the Cuban Five and against terrorism. Given the struggle in Ireland against imperialism, British imperialism, what does it mean for you to be here and for the Irish people to be connected to this issue?
The experience of Cuba is very similar in a lot of ways to the experience of Ireland, with a very powerful negative enemy, empire quite close to our shores, being an island nation, long struggle for independence and a disregard for independence. The issue of prisoners is an issue that's particularly close to Irish people who have any political conscience. We had a very integral part of the political struggle in Ireland took place within prisons, developed within prisons, and the politics that are in effect today in Ireland, which led to the peace process, had their origins within the prison struggle directly after a hunger strike in which 10 patriots died. It was on that basis that I initially made contact with the Cuban Five prisoners on a personal level. And through that, became involved in the solidarity work. It means a lot for me. It's a very important issue. I mean, it's an issue for the men themselves, for their families, for their people, but it's also a global issue. It's a real indication of how dangerous and nasty US imperialism is and the importance of uniting in solidarity against such a terrible enemy.
Now, describe for listeners how this movement manifests itself in Ireland. What kind of things are people doing? What are the sentiments on the ground regarding the Cuban Five and just the U.S. imperialism against Cuba?
Generally, in Ireland, people may not be as politically conscious of the whole imperialism issue as the Cuban Five issue. There might be a difference there. Regarding the Cuban Five, there's action on the 5th of every month, as there is across the world, to highlight the situation of the Cuban Five. And that takes the place of protests in front of the embassy, handing out leaflets, doing various activities. There would be a high degree of support and empathy with the situation of the prisoners within Ireland, within trade union movements, within certain political parties, and within independent politicians. The case of, the understanding of imperialism is a little bit broader in some ways and more specific in other ways for people there.
Mm-hmm. Now, what message would you give as an Irish person to President Obama and the people of the United States where in fact the five are being held?
I would say to him that there is no situation, no political environment that justifies the detention of innocent men. And in this case, men that are more than innocent. They're not like men who were passively innocent and wrongly arrested. They were men who were actively involved in actions that the US should support. And not only should he release them, he should recognize the fact that what they were doing was decent and good and right and essentially patriotic. He should release the five immediately and send them home unconditionally without any delay.
Thank you, brother.
You're welcome, brother.
Cuba no se rinde. Seguro que no. Aquí no hay miedo. Todo el mundo. Cuba no se rinde. Aquí no hay miedo. No hay miedo. Cuba no se rinde. Aquí no hay miedo. Te lo dice mi pueblo. Cuba no se rinde. Aquí no hay miedo. No hay miedo. Cuba no se rinde. Aquí no hay miedo. Ah, bueno.
Some people say that they think that it was naive for the Cuban government to trust the FBI to do the right thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are two things that cannot be confused. I mean, the Cuban government didn't give the FBI information that led them to us. As a matter of fact, the evidence showed that the FBI was after us a little while before Cuba approached the FBI. Cuba gave the FBI concrete information related to terrorism against Cuba. in the hopes that the U.S. would follow that leads and the two countries could work together. So what happened is that the fact that the both governments were approaching, that there was some kind of approach between the Clinton administration and Cuba that could lead to working together against terrorism, brought up the political decision by some people of prosecuting us to put an end to the to that potential cooperation. So it's two different things. And that's part of the dynamics of the relations between Cuba and the U.S. Usually, every time that the two governments can approach, that there is a potential for approach between the two governments, there is a sector of the U.S. political establishment, and especially in Miami, which do something in order to prevent that to happen, from happening. And that's exactly what happened this time around.
This was the first of what will be a series of audio mixes on the 9th Colloquium in Holguín, Cuba, for the freedom of the Cuban Five and against terrorism, that took place from November 13th to the 16th, 2013. Featured was an interview with Kwame Ture speaking on Fidel Castro and Cuba, with the song Eyes of March and the song Cinco Heroes by the Cuban hip-hop duo Crazy Rappers. There are lots more interesting interviews and music to come in the weeks to follow. For Voices with Vision, I'm Netfer Freeman.
And that was Netfer Freeman. I hope you appreciate that. I certainly do. It's not any kind of easy task to sift through hours of audio. And to edit it and put it into a really nice piece like that one, and I'm sure the ones that are forthcoming from Netfer Freeman. So I thank him for his work, and I really hope that everyone listening to this program right now appreciates and got something out of which is most important, that you got something out of that piece that was just played by Netfer Freeman. And with that being said, as we wait for Norman Richmond to come on. Tim, you were telling me before the show started that we'll leave the names anonymous, but you said that there are folks that had emailed you. I guess you were part of some kind of listserv, and folks emailed you, and they were had all these kind of slogans and sayings about Mandela, and were just saying all these things about Mandela, what was your reaction to that? Because I guess it really is based on the carrier of the information, because someone who has like a track record of and is actively doing things in the community or a part of something, trying to organize or just in general has a track record of speaking out and organizing against injustice. Certainly, they have a much more solid footing, to really talk about Mandela and his life and what he, what he stood for and what he was, what he's become known, for in terms of fighting, and that's apartheid. I mean, this is a man who, at one time early in his life, he was a part of Imkonto Wesizwe, which otherwise known as MK, which is the military wing of the ANC, and so he's no stranger to struggle, and as I said before, like, make no illusion about it, South Africa still to this day remains a very, very dire situation, although the Western media won't tell you about it. But over 85% of the arable land in South Africa is in the control of whites, so it's an economic apartheid. Black South Africans continue to live in squalid townships and encampments with no running water, no plumbing system for their their toilets, which are outhouses, and, you know, maybe 25 families share an outhouse. I mean, this still goes on to this day. So don't get caught up in all this, you know, this stuff today, like, without remembering what is going on in South Africa right now, because there still are people on the ground that are still struggling and fighting and organizing to bring full circle the dreams and hopes of what came, you know, after the end of physical apartheid. But these people right now continue to live in an economic apartheid, and they are struggling. There are organizations and individuals on the ground. I can't say the ANC, because the ANC has become very much a corporate, you know, party of the elites, and has really lost touch with its original dreams. I mean, its original aspirations and mission. This is the ANC. As we know, the PAC, you know, members like Robert Sobukwe split from the ANC because they didn't feel, and they formed the PAC because they didn't feel the ANC was moving in as progressive as a direction as it should. And you know, the ANC, you know, they didn't embrace the Freedom Charter. The Freedom Charter, within the Freedom Charter, folks, if you want to just Google South Africa's Freedom Charter, you can get the entire charter online and just read through it and read it. And it talks about the nationalization of mines, such as the gold mines that are in South Africa. And the nationalization means that the people are going to be the primary beneficiaries from that. That's not the case now. These corporations like Lone Men, you know, and the Marikana massacre that just happened, you know, this past year, that stems from, you know, these corporations' control of it and corporate interests, and people in the ANC, you know, who have sold out and sold out the people and have put their support behind the corporate interests because they're benefiting from that. So, you know, that it's really important that you don't just get caught up in idolatry and just looking at the idol of people, you know, as folks like to do with Malcolm X, just looking at Malcolm and just looking at the X. But if your actions and your philosophies don't support Malcolm's work in some shape, form, or fashion, then it's like you are nothing less than just a you know, just some kind of brand whore. I'm just going to wear the brand of Malcolm. I'm just going to tout it around and just say, you know, Malcolm X, and I'm going to say Mandela. I'm going to say Amandala. You know, but you really don't support what these men were about in the first place, because you continue to support imperialists and warmongers and apartheid in places like Israel and Palestine, you know, which Palestine, you know, Israel is Palestine, and continue to support Obama and so forth. You know, lose it. Lose the rhetoric. Stop it. You know, don't make Mandela roll around in his grave anymore, you know, or Malcolm, you know, roll around in his grave, you know, because we have a bunch of just, you know, fools just running around, just, you know, shouting off, you know, just, you know, empty rhetoric. And I say empty because their actions are nothing that resembles, you know, the words and the actions that came from the bodies and the mouths of the likes of Mandela, Sobukwe, Steve Biko, Ida B. Wells, Fannie Lou Hamer, and the like. So I see we have... But Tim, just real quick before we welcome on Norman Richmond, what was your reaction to that, to those emails that you've been getting?
I was just extremely frustrated because, as you said, that hypocrisy of not having that track record of work that goes in line and is parallel to, or at least in the same ballpark as Nelson Mandela's, and then quoting his name is extreme hypocrisy and basically just makes you a fraud. But that is exactly what the corporate media, the ruling white supremacist elite in this country want. They want to make freedom fighters such as Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, or Nelson Mandela into these teddy bear figures that are harmless and that anyone can quote, and as Obama, quote them hypocritically. But what they don't want is you to continue their work and to continue that struggle, which is necessary today.
That's right. That's right. So... without further ado, I'm going to welcome on this brother, and I want to say, since we're about to talk about music, Your World News, we have recently produced, you know, our third major documentary. We have other documentaries, but the third major documentary was just released, and it's entitled Hip Hop, White Supremacy and Capitalism, Why Corporations Infiltrated Rap Music. If you go to yourworldnews.org, I repeat, if you go to www.yourworldnews.org, you will find that documentary there, and it is free. It is free for you and the rest of the world to view. Please watch it, and please send it to all of your networks far and wide, especially those who continue to be obsequious, you know, servants to corporate back rap and buying into everything that they put out there, the stereotypical images of black and brown people, the misogyny, sexism, but we, you know, without ever realizing that these white corporations have green-lighted and promoted and created these cookie-cutter molds, you know, to sign artists who are willing to sell out their community for, you know, fame. So watch this documentary. It's got artists, it's got activists and scholars, the like. And so, you know, we really encourage you, please. That's how you can support us. Watch the documentary and spread it to everyone you know. So I'm going to welcome on this brother, Norman Otis Richmond, who is originally from Arcadia, Louisiana. And I want to kind of just go off script. I've been reading Norman's work for quite some time on Black Agenda Report. I've listened to his radio broadcasts on Uhura Radio. He's a musicologist, and I'm going off script. You know, I'm just he's a musicologist. The brother knows anything and everything when it comes to music, and especially black music. And that's why we welcome him on, help him on this program. And so whether it's jazz, blues, soul, you know, he knows it. And we're going to talk to him about the history of black music. We're going to talk to him about how black music was co-opted by white folks and white corporations. And also, most importantly, what black folks, Africans need to do to reclaim African music in the U.S. But, you know, he's an organizer. He has a long history of organizing. He refused to fight in the Vietnam War because he felt like the Vietnamese and Africans, you know, united, which they were. After leaving Los Angeles, he lived in Los Angeles in the 60s, and after leaving Los Angeles in the 60s, Norman Richmond moved to Toronto, where he co-founded the Afro-American Progressive Association, which is one of the first black power organizations in that part of the world, one of the first. So this man is an organizer. That's what I'm talking about, doing it. That's what I'm talking about, people. If you don't create an organization, then join one that's about something. Don't just run around. Norman wasn't running around chanting the, you know, empty rhetoric and wearing a daishiki and so forth. He was saying, you know what, if I do those things, those things need to be anchored by actions. And so he was doing that. Norman also worked with the Detroit-based League of Revolutionary Black Workers. He was the youngest member of the central staff. The league was a part of the movement that included the Revolutionary Action Movement, otherwise known as RAM, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, otherwise known as SNCC, the Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, All African Revolutionary Party, and the African People's Socialist Party. In 1992, Richmond received the Toronto Arts Award. In front of that audience, when he received that award, in part of the audience was the mayor of Toronto. Richmond dedicated his award, and this is really big because in front of, you know, that entire audience, whether it was mainstream politicians or not, he said that he dedicated that award to Mumia Abu-Jamal, Asada Shakur, Geronimo Pratt, late great Geronimo Pratt, the African National Congress of South Africa, Fidel Castro, and the people of Cuba. Richmond began his career as a journalist, and he worked for the African Canadian Weekly Contrast, and he went on to be published in the Toronto Star, the Toronto Globe, the Mail, Toronto Globe and Mail, the National Post, the Jaskin Advocate, The Islander, I mean, we can go on and on. The Pan-African Newswire, Black Agenda Report, where you can find a lot of his pieces. You know, he's internationally, he's also written for the United Nations, the Jamaican Gleaner, The Nation, which is a paper in Barbados, and Pambazuka News. So without further ado, and you know what, sometimes people think that, you know, intros are long-winded. I, in this instance, you know, believe that this intro is... is just and perhaps does not even come close to even doing the man's work and the man himself justice. So without further ado, welcome on to Your World News, Norman Otis Richmond.
Thank you for that introduction. I don't know who you were talking about.
Yeah. We're talking about you. And you know, we appreciate you calling in from Toronto. And I just actually, before we even, you know, get started with the interview itself in terms of what we want to ask you, I just want to ask you what did Nelson Mandela mean to you? And maybe you can even talk about what, you know, since you have adoration for Fidel Castro and the people of Cuba, you can't separate the people of Cuba and Fidel Castro from Nelson Mandela, you know, what they mean to you as well.
Well, I remember Nelson Mandela. I know the mainstream press is not going to talk about this, but I remember Nelson Mandela as an ally of Fidel Castro, as an ally of Muammar Gaddafi, as an ally of the Palestinian Liberation Organization when Yasser Arafat was the head of it. And I remember Nelson Mandela, who was trained in Algeria. And, you know, Algeria is a country where you had a man by the name of Ahmed Ben Bella, who was the head of the movement there, and that is where the Black Panther Party had their international office in Algiers. And you know, I remember Mandela in those like that. But I know that the mainstream press probably is not going to deal with that. They're going to deal with the fact that he met the Dalai Lama and he did this and he did. You know what I mean? They're gonna water him down like they do anyone that's that was really struggling. They always water you down. Like Martin Luther King, we know that a year before Martin Luther King was killed, he was public enemy number one. But now when they talk about Martin Luther King, he might as well be Prophet Muhammad or Jesus, you know, the way they talk about him.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that. I wanted to just ask you, to get a broad overview on, you talk about, you know, your research, you know, and your studies with the history of Black music, and you know, why have you spent so many years studying Black music itself?
My father was a music fanatic, and all of his children have basically, and I inherited that from my father, and I happened to try to sing at one point, and I recorded music, and I, you know, I cut records and so on and so forth, and I was always getting into trouble with these groups because, you know, when I was 14 years old, I went to the Muhammad's Mosque number 27. And that kind of, you know, I didn't join at that particular time, but you know, I was really deeply influenced, and I was always kind of outspoken, and I really couldn't stay in groups a lot of times because I was always be talking about, as they say, this Black stuff, and you know, a lot of times, a lot of guys at that time wanted to get money and get women. And a lot of them wanted to get white women, you know, and I was talking this Black nationalist stuff, so, you know, it always got me, you know, got me into trouble. But music, my father basically turned me on to music, and after Malcolm was, you know, assassinated, I got really interested in the, you know, the history of African people, and music was just a part of it.
Thank you, Norman. Can you tell us the true history behind rock and roll? Because a lot of folks don't know that rock and roll itself is an African creation. You know, it was African in the Americas, like Chuck Berry, who are the original, you know, fathers of rock and roll. Can you talk to us about that, and how did, you know, and how did rock and roll become, you know, come to be named rock and roll, and why, and who were the folks that you know, usurped it and renamed it what it is today?
Well, I think they give the credit for Alan Freed for coining the term rock and roll, but Alan Freed was a DJ out of, I think it was out of Cleveland, and he was kind of a mixed bag because he promoted a lot of black music, basically, and he had something to do with the Moonglows. I think he's quoted, or he's maybe credited with co-writing Sincerely, which I don't think he had anything to do with that, but he was tight with the folks, and, you know, he was indicted for pill and all that kind of stuff, but they basically, like, demonized him. But, you know, rock and roll was, you know, created by, you know, Ike Turner did a lot of things around rock and roll, but, you know, when we think about rock and roll, we should think about Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and these are the people that really created that form. And then the press and the society made Elvis Presley the king of rock and roll. But as we know, the king and queen of rock and roll is Little Richard. And we have, you know, and the, I've been seeing, I saw this movie Muscle Shoals, and I saw this film 20 Feet from Stardom. And, you know, all of those, basically, if you see those films, you'll basically see that our people have created this music, but we've been used in the sense that we never get the credit. Like, if you go to YouTube and you look at the 20 Feet from Stardom, you will see Mick Jagger is on the trailer. You know, then you open it up with, you know, the people talking are like Bruce Springsteen and, you know, and folks like that. Now, to give credit to Bruce Springsteen, he's basically saying that these are the originators and should be given the credit, you know. But I have problems with Mick Jagger because I don't really think that I think he's gotten too much credit, and he's been very shrewd in terms of being able to attract the first hit they had was a Bobby Womack song. It's all over now. They were able to use the reggae music. They were able to use African music, and he has a good ear, and he knows which way the wind is blowing. So, you know, black music is rock and roll music is African based music, and we just don't get the credit for it.
Thank you, Norman. My next question is, could you talk a little bit about the connection between blues and jazz?
Well, blues and jazz comes out of, you know, gospel music. And, you know, gospel music comes out of Africa. You know, it's the music that the Africans in America made when we were, you know, enslaved. And we took our African forms and put it into the religion that was forced upon us. And then the blues, you know, people who didn't really want to deal with that whole religious thing, people that like to party and drink and chase women and men getting together. The secular forces, you know, they created the blues, and then a little bit later, jazz came about, and the jazz folks were a little bit more, I wouldn't say they were better musicians, but they took it to a higher level, and at that time, I guess the society was such a, in such a way that the jazz musicians became some of the most political people that you could think about, because I remember I had the opportunity of really knowing Max Roach a little bit. I used to speak to Max, Mr. Roach, three or four times a year. And he was basically telling me, like in the 1940s, there was a man by the name of Cuffy Gunner by Guy Warren, who is a Ghanaian. He said that he brought kente cloth to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Those guys were like wearing kente cloth like in the 40s. And, of course, they looked to Africa. They looked to they were into the African culturally they went to Africa, but they also supported the liberation movements in Africa as well. And so they had the cultural front and the political front. Max Roach went on to record the song in 1960 or 1961, "Freedom Now Sweet," or "We Insist Freedom Now Sweet." And then you had people like Randy Weston, who recorded "Uhuru Africa" around the same period. And at that particular time, the South African government, since we're talking about South Africa, the South African government banned all of those songs. They banned "We Insist Freedom Now Sweet." They banned Randy Weston's "Uhuru Africa." They banned Lena Horne's song because it had the title "Now" in it. Anything that had "Now" in it, or "Freedom" or "Now," was banned by the South African government in 1964. You can go to Downbeat magazine and they talk about that. And there's been many books that talk about that. So gospel is Africa is the source, but the Africans in America created gospel. Our wayward people who, got away from the religion thing created blues, and then the jazz folks took it to a different level in terms of explicitly talking about politics,
Right. Norman, what you talked about gospel, and obviously, the predecessor to that was like the field hollers and the jump-ups.
Yes, sir.
Can you talk about why music was so important to these enslaved Africans, what kind of role it played in their day-to-day lives, for inspiration or even to motivate them to rise up and resist, for instance, looking at the Stoner Rebellion, many of those Africans, played the drums as they walked through South Carolina. What was the importance, and can you also give our listeners a broad, because these Africans came from a place where, drums were very prominent, music was very prominent, different instruments, and when they were enslaved and brought over to different parts of the Western Hemisphere, and just looking at the U.S., focusing on the U.S., correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that music was an aspect of their culture, one of the many aspects of their culture that was ripped away from them. Why was it so? Why was music so important to them, and why was it so important for their slave masters to take away that aspect of their culture?
Well, the drums, basically, I think the Africans in America were, the drums were banned from African people in America, and music was part of, it's functional in African culture. I mean, there's music for when you have a child, there's music. When you get married, there's music. When you go to war, there's music. And the oppressor, he realized that the music was powerful, and they basically tried to stop that. But in the fields, I don't know if they made a mistake, but they allowed. Or the Africans could sing, to break the monotony. And I can imagine that many of them probably like what they heard, because a lot of racist folks love African music, Because there's a whole lot of rednecks who like Bob Marley right now. If you deal with the appeal of Bob Marley, that's worldwide we're talking about, all over Europe and so on and so forth. And even today, a lot of our people, a lot of African people, in the whole Western Hemisphere don't care anything about blues, but they love blues in Europe today, Japan, you know, in many parts of the world. So I hope that answered what I tried to. I hope that answered what you wanted to know.
Definitely, it definitely does.
Thank you, Norman. This is Tim again. I wanted to know what role have the events in society determined what artists like James Brown, the Last Poets, or Jill Scott Heron performed in their music?
Oh, I think that the artist has been influenced by the movement, by the conditions, and there is a new book out called Party Music by Ricky Vincent, and he basically talked about how you know, the Black Panther Party had a group called the Lumpin', and they were responding to the, not just them, but they were responding to the events of the day, you know. And I think that if you take a music like Calypso and you take a music like reggae, they were not under the corporate capitalist situation, and I think they served as the music served as like newspapers, although reggae music had a lot of lovey-dovey type of stuff. It still had another element of you know, the whole revolutionary thing, whereas in the United States of America, you had an industry, so you had a choice. First of all, they didn't want African people to use music to in America to use music to promote any kind of struggle. So they put they had the Africans basically trying to get a hit record. So in order to get a hit record, you are not going to try to offend the record companies, or you're trying to sell records, even though a lot of the corporations didn't even care about African music in the beginning. But I think the African folks, the music has, the movement always influenced the music and not the other way around. You know, James Brown was responding to the conditions. You know, Rap Brown says that he basically, he put some heat on James Brown, and James Brown came out with "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud," and I believe that's true.
Thank you. I wanted to look at jazz, and if you could talk about, this is kind of a loaded question, if you could talk about the brilliance of some of the artists that in jazz that you know, you're really have a lot of adoration for, whether it's, you know, the brilliance of Coltrane or Miles or Dizzy, what have you. And if you could talk about how some of these African jazz artists, you know, how they came to you know, because I know some of them, you know, died, you know, penniless or close to penniless or you know, or just never even received the profits that they deserved. And you know, in comparison to, you know, white folks and white corporations that now own their music and have really profited from these other artists. Because one of the things that you know, I you know, hate seeing is, like, you know, people prop up like the likes of Kenny G as jazz, and this guy, I mean, this guy is talentless, you know, I don't know, you know what, and you know, he's making more money than Coltrane or Dizzy or Miles, you know what I'm saying, you know, ever did, you know what I'm saying? And he's got, you know, they had more talent in their little pinkies than he has in his entire body.
Well, I'll just say this about first before I answer the question. I remember seeing Peebo Bryson one time, and I became real close with Peebo Bryson. But Peebo Bryson asked me to help his sister get into the concert, and this was a concert with Peebo Bryson and Kenny G. They were supposed to be co-headlining. So Peebo Bryson she had had an accident, so she was on a, you know, had a walker, had a walking stick, and she was basically cursing like Lena, not Lena Horne, but cursing like Sarah Vaughan. She was calling, you know, what the, is my brother doing with this no plan, blah, 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 talking about Kenny G. But, yeah, Kenny G is another story. But in terms of the jazz musicians, one of the persons that has really inspired me was Archie Shepp. Now, Archie Shepp, I named my show Diasporic Music as a result of basically talking to him. Diasporic music is the music that African people made outside of Africa. But my show, I do play African music, but diasporic music, or I guess the proper English would be diasporic music, but I say diasporic music, would embrace everything from Bessie Smith to Burning Spear, and I could play everything from samba to hip-hop, you know, so it's broad, 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 broad. Also, I could play music from the English-speaking, French-speaking, Dutch-speaking, the Spanish, the whole, all the language, all the colonizers that took us, we created music, from all those territories. But Archie Shepp came up with the term diasporic music, so I use the term diasporic music, But I met Archie Shepp, and I saw him the first time, I think, in the Spirit House in Newark, New Jersey. And in Newark, New Jersey. And then I began to – I didn't meet him at that particular time because, to be perfectly honest, I was basically underground at that particular time, running from the draft. But when I finally – he used to write a column in the Downbeat magazine, and he talked about being anti-war, pro-Vietnam, you know, because Ho Chi Minh wrote articles about lynching. Ho Chi Minh lived in the United States. Ho Chi Minh used to go to UNIA meetings. So, you know, I learned a lot of stuff from Archie Shepp's about, you know, struggles of other people and the whole concept of diasporic music, you know, I got from him, and I saw him last year in Los Angeles. You know, I hadn't seen him in many years, and he is a guy who, the way he is surviving is he lives in Paris now. You know, he doesn't even live in the United States. Coltrane, to give you a good story, Coltrane didn't die broke. Coltrane had his publishing together, but he is a rarity. Dizzy, I think, might have made some money, and Max might have made some money because Max, you know, taught school and so on and so forth. But they are exceptions to the rule. Most of the most brilliant musicians died broke, and the publishing was owned by some Euro-Americans or some other Euro people from Germany, so on and so forth, and they are benefiting from all of these creations.
Thank you, Norman. This is Tim again. I wanted to ask you, in 2012, you wrote an open letter to President Obama titled, "What About We People Who Are Darker Than Blue?" Could you tell us what that open letter consisted of and why you wrote it?
Basically, I wrote the letter because June is Black Music Month, and going back to 79, I believe, or 78, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Little Richard, Evelyn Champagne King, Kenny Gamble, there's a woman named Dina Williams. I want to give her credit. I think she's in Philly. They went to Washington, D.C., and President Carter proclaimed June Black Music Month. And, you know, in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, record companies used to give out samples of black music. They took ads out in magazines. June is Black Music Month, la da 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 da. Then it died out, And when President Barack Hussein Obama was elected president, he changed it to African-American Music Appreciation Month, which basically took the Pan-African or the international element out. And when the Black Music Association began, one of the things that they did was they put together Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder. If you go back and there's photographs that were taken by Kwame Brathwaite, who is the brother of Ilombe Brath. He took these photos of Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder, very iconic photographs. And one of the things that the BMA was trying to do was to unite all forms of Black music. And, you know, you had some of the jazz musicians that were upset because they didn't think they were getting enough credit. You had, you know, some calypso folks that, you know, were upset. And maybe the jazz musicians and the calypsonians may have had a point. But the point was that the Black Music Association was trying to deal with Black music, period, and not just rhythm and blues, jazz, and gospel, but they wanted to deal with it, even the African beats, because Dick Griffey, who was the head of the Black Music Association, we were attempting to have the Black Music Association convention in Lagos, Nigeria, but that never happened because of, I think at that time, there was a lot of politics going on, and there was a lot of people didn't want to go to Africa because some people didn't want to go because they thought it was unstable. Other people didn't want to go because they didn't want to have anything to do with Africa. But is there another point you want to make about that?
No, just wanted to just get your reflection on that piece because we were telling our listeners that, you know, that's one of the places where they can find your writings is Black Agenda Report. I remember that piece came out. I remember reading that piece when it first came out, and I was really appreciative that you addressed that issue within the open letter because I thought the piece that you wrote was very on point, spot on.
Could I say that Archie Shepp made the point that what Malcolm played, Coltrane. What Malcolm said Coltrane played, and he pointed out the fact that, you know, in the 60s you had Malcolm and Train, and in the 70s you had Bob Marley and Walter Rodney, and then later on you had, you had Fela and Thomas Sankara, you know, sort of going back and forth to the politics and the music complementing one another.
Thank you. And so in that same vein, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, some of our listeners are younger and it's kind of plays in par for a question that I'm going to ask after this question. But I wanted to first ask you if you could shed some light on some of the artists that you can think of, some of the African artists that you can think of, whether they were American-born Africans or if they're in places like South Africa, like Mary Makeba, artists that you can think of that did not shy away from addressing politics or political struggle, you know, or liberation, not just in their music, but also in their rhetoric when they were asked these questions. And I would say, I would also put in the vein, in terms of musicians, you know, he was a musician with his voice, you know, Paul Robeson. So if you could answer that question.
Well, I guess the first one I would have to say would be Fela Kuti out of Nigeria, was very, very, very outspoken. And I had the pleasure of meeting Fela on many occasions, and I actually went to his home and to the Calicutta Republic, and I found that Fela Kuti was basically, he credits Los Angeles with basically turning him on, to Pan-Africanism. Those are his words, not mine. I also think of Peter Tosh, who I think has been really neglected. I was talking to one of my best friends from Antigua, who can't stand Peter. I don't know why, but yeah, he says, I was basically saying, you know, Peter Tosh could play every instrument, and he just said that Peter was just an angry Black man. But I think Peter Tosh was one of my favorites, Marion McCabe. I love Marion McCabe because she stood for the liberation of not only South Africans but Africans period. She had passports from I don't know how many passports she had from Guinea, from Algeria, all kind of passports because you know people loved her. I like Mighty Sparrow. He has a kind of a mixed bag, but a lot of things Sparrow did, he was way ahead of his time. That song "Slave," I think, is classic. Abby Lincoln, Aminata Museka, the work she did with Max Roach, and Max Roach is special, but Aminata Museka, I don't think she gets the credit that she deserves. Of course, Nina Simone. Nina Simone. I can't say enough about Nina Simone. I can't say enough about the I3s. Judy Marwitt. I don't want to single them out, but Judy Marwitt. Judy Marwitt produced a lot of her stuff. The Black Woman album. Marcia Griffiths is a great artist. Rita Marley is a brilliant person in terms of holding her situation together. And I'm trying to think a lot of Cuban artists that that politically I don't know that much about, but Benny Moré out of Cuba. I've been listening to him, quite a bit recently, and Gil Scott-Heron. I can't mention him enough because he is, maybe one of the most brilliant artists that ever walked the earth. You know what I mean? And I love Gil Scott-Heron. I met him in 1976 and stayed in contact with him as much as I could. And he, his former wife, Brenda Sykes, is a cousin of my Uncle Prentice's Rose, my Aunt Rose. So every time I used to see Gil Scott-Heron, I'd say, "What's happening, cuz?" You know, and we would always laugh about that. But, Gil Scott-Heron, I think we definitely need to keep his music alive. And coming out of he was born in the United States. His father was born in Jamaica, and he has relatives up here in Toronto. So I know many of his relatives. I never can forget Gil Scott-Heron.
Thank you. Tim and I have like a tag team question. I'm gonna set the stage for this question, and then Tim's gonna actually ask the question. But I was just thinking, Brother Norman, that when you look at the relationship that whites and white corporations have had with black music, it has been an extremely exploitative one. Whether it's Elvis Presley, and him exploiting, music from the relationship with jazz and looking at even, and it, the ironic thing is, Norman, is that you would have white folks, going to places like the Cotton Club, to go be regaled by vastly talented, black artists, and dancers. But at the same time, these black people, these Africans, could not even sit in those same clubs that they were entertained. They had to go someplace else. They had to go someplace else to entertain. They had to go. They had to be kept in the back of the venue, in the kitchen and so forth. And that's the ironic thing is that these white folks. It seems like these white folks had no. It's just the hypocrisy. They just a bunch of damn you know, hypocrites and you know, I could go on and on, you know, in terms of the treatment that, you know, that our ancestors, you know, went through, you know, in the early 20th century and before. And so, you know, the question that I'm going to turn over to Tim, you know, has to do with that, has to do with looking at, you know, you identifying the start of where you would say when whites really began to monetarily profit from black music. And Tim, what did you want to...
Yeah, and when they really began to seize control of the African music industry here in the United States.
I think, first of all, I wanted to mention Duke Ellington. I should have mentioned Duke Ellington as one of our greats. But Duke Ellington had to have a white manager. When I say he had to have a white manager, I think he basically said that, or theoretically people have basically said that had he not had the white manager, he wouldn't have got the exposure that he got. Louis Armstrong had to have a a white manager in order to do what he did. But I think that from the get go, from the beginning of the music industry, the African music has been exploited, you know, and that started when the recording industry started, and there has been an exploitive relationship with Chess Records, you know, all of those blues artists. The Chess Brothers were, I think, they're originally out of Poland and you know, Polish background, backgrounds. They, I remember, I did a panel one time in Toronto, and there was a Jewish dude on the panel with me, and he basically was a very progressive guy, and we saw this film about Stax Record, and he was basically saying, he basically told me quietly, he says, you know, he said, I know you're a radical. He said, but let me handle this. Since I'm Jewish, let me handle this situation. And he talked about, he said, you look at Leonard Feather's teeth and you look at the way he did and look at the artists, the way they were treated. And he talked about how they basically, and not because Leonard Feather was Jewish, but the whole capitalist thing, they basically exploited us. The whole situation with Clive Davis and Arista Records, so CBS before that, you know, Clive Davis made a deal with, I guess he made a deal with Stax Records, he made a deal with Philadelphia International, and they came out on top of those situations. Dick Griffey, the late, great Dick Griffey, he left America and moved to Ghana, and basically said he didn't want to deal with the whole corporate thing, because they basically, Dick Griffey was worth maybe $100 million at one point. He didn't die broke, I don't want to say that, but he basically was forced out of the music industry because they basically told him he wasn't selling enough records at that particular time. And he was the guy who told me, he says that every year for the Whispers Christmas album, I think he said he got maybe I don't know, millions of dollars just off of one Christmas album. But the problem is that the capitalists always control in the final analysis. They've come out on top on our music, and when it started, I think it started as soon as the music industry started, but it really picked up in the in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, when Clive Davis made the deals with Philadelphia International and Stax Records and so on and so forth. I think that's my analysis.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. What are your thoughts? Okay, since we're talking about exploitation, you know, you being a very prideful African, and your history, you know, speaks for itself. What are your thoughts about the current realm of what we see on TV, whether it's, you know, BET, MTV, VH1, all owned by Viacom, of course, you know, any of the corporate urban radio stations, whether it's Hot 97 in New York or, you know, Q in Seattle, you know, any of these corporate radio stations that play hip-hop, what are your thoughts as an elder African, prideful elder African, what are your thoughts with corporate-backed hip-hop today, and when you see these young brothers and sisters who perhaps really don't understand the scope of how they're being exploited, how they're being, ushered along like modern-day minstrels and sambos and Jezebels, you know, only to profit, you know, large, you know, white mega media corporations. You know, so what is your thought about hip-hop and the corporate artists that you see today?
Well, first of all, I don't really talk about this too much, but I don't even own a TV, so I spent about 8 months in Los Angeles recently, so I got a chance to watch a lot of Scandal and all that kind of stuff. But I watched some of the videos. I blame the record industry mostly for that situation, because a lot of these guys, these hip hop artists, they want to get paid, and they are willing, I guess, to do the coon thing in order to get paid. But I think that the situation with the record companies is that they basically exploit that, and it really takes a lot to be independent. You know, like, there's a group called The Coup. I've always liked The Coup, but, you know, I guess Boots Riley is, we're dealing with a whole different generation in terms of Boots, age-wise, is not, a young cat anymore. But I feel sorry for those for the buffoon thing. But I feel sorry for them, because it's almost, they've taken us back to Step and Fetch It was, I think, when Step and Fetch It passed away, he might have been in the Nation of Islam, you know. So a lot of these, if the joke is not on, I have a problem with comedians that make fun of our own people. I'm a Richard Pryor, Paul Mooney type of person, you know what I mean? If you make the oppressor the joke, I'm in love with that. But I think that a lot of the young rappers are in a situation where it's demeaning. But like I say, I don't completely blame them, and I know a lot of people would get mad at me for saying that. But I blame the imperialist capitalist system for putting us in a situation where some of us have to do that in order to earn a living, which is why we have to try to create a whole new society for Africans and all oppressed people.
Thank you, Norman. This is Tim again. My next question actually piggybacks off of what you just said about that. That improved a new society. And specifically, I wanted to ask, how can Africans, both African musicians and African people who listen to African music, African people as a whole, how can they reclaim not only just their music, but the distribution, everything from the distribution of their music, the control over the ownership of that music, and the images that music features?
Well, I think the internet offers an opening. The major record companies are basically either unable or unwilling to promote us. So to promote us, if we want to have we have to cut out the middleman and learn about the business of music. Like when we were in the business of when we were out there in the beginning, a lot of us didn't know anything about the music, the business part of it. You know, there were a few people like Curtis Mayfield, Ray Charles, Brooke Benton, and other women that, you know, knew about publishing, but I think that the younger people need to know about publishing and need to know about the new technology. Cut the middleman out and try to control, like Chuck D talked about, trying to control as much of yourself as you can. And I think that is that's the way I think we should go, you know. Don't deal with the corporate record companies any longer. And, you know, the whole situation with internet radio is something that's going to grow and grow and grow. And, you know, we can promote our things in South Africa, in Ghana, in Germany, in Holland, in just like on Facebook. I have friends from Sweden. I have friends from Germany. These are African people that I'm talking about. Friends from, the African continent, the Caribbean. So I think we have to use the new technology in order to promote our culture. And, of course, PayPal and all of this, these sort of technologies, how you get paid, we have to be on top of that. But I just think we basically have to cut the middleman, who most of the time was a white man. But I know that you guys are not into the whole thing about you don't want to be exploited by somebody just because they're black, you know what I mean? So we want an egalitarian situation where we get paid, you know, so we don't want to be oppressed by white or black oppressors or Chinese oppressors or Indian oppressors. We want, you know, we basically want egalitarian situation where we can get everything we should get in terms of our money and our freedom.
I couldn't agree more. And my last question is just to ask you really quickly, you know, well, it's not my last question, but I hope that, you know, that you'll consider coming on the show again. I would love to have you on periodically.
Anytime. I like your work, so I would be appreciated tremendously.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is there any way, folks that are listening right now that want to build with you, that want to connect with you online, is there an email or is there a way they can get in contact with you and your work? Because I let folks know that, you know, that you also have hosted quite a few online radio shows, and I believe those are also archived, just like your articles on you know, Pan-African Newswire with Abiyomi Ezekwe. You were just recently on one of his internet-based radio shows. How can they get a hold of you, maybe to ask you for more information on music, to pick your brain, and maybe even to get you to send them some of the pieces that you've written before?
You can email me, Norman. .o.richmond, R-I-C-H-M-O-N-D, @gmail.com. That's Norman, N-O-R-M-A-N, .o.richmond, R-I-C-H-M-O-N-D, @gmail.com. And I'm on Facebook. You can friend me on Facebook, and I have a blog, and I can get the blog is being constructed. It's up there, but it's kind of problematic, and I can get, you know, there's a lot of my information on the blog, but if you email me or you do the Facebook situation, I like the Facebook situation because I can stay in contact with a lot of people. And I would like to say that, you know, that whole Facebook thing is can be used for technology, like Kwame Ture used to always say, can be used for good or bad, or, you know, if you're going to get on there on Facebook and talk about what you had for dinner, you know, that's a whole nother thing. But the state knows what you're doing anyway, so you don't just put any crazy stuff on Facebook. So I think we should use it. That's how I come down on that issue.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. And I really, it means a lot to me that an elder African like yourself appreciates the work that we've been trying to do here at Your World News, and you know, your support, that, you know, literally it means the world to us. So thank you so much, brother.
All right, and keep up your good work, because I check your things out every time you post something.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'll be posting this article, this episode of Your World News very soon, so you should get in your email.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Thank you, Norman.
Take care.
All right.
So, folks, that was Norman Richmond, and that was, you know, quite frankly, one of the priceless, you know, interviews that we've done. You know, you cannot, you know, place a price tag on that interview in any shape, form, or fashion, because knowledge, you know, is priceless. Knowledge is priceless, and it should be priceless. Knowledge should not be kept, you know, in the halls and respiratories or repositories of these elitist, you know, academic institutions, you know, throughout the world. You know, it should be available free to the public, to the masses, to draw inspiration, to draw knowledge, to learn how they can better organize, because the more you learn about various issues, the more equipped you are to organize around tackling those issues. And so when the brother talks about, you know, connecting the music to liberation struggles, when he talks about his thoughts and perspectives on how, you know, African people can reclaim their music, you know, it says something, it means something, and it should. And you know, my hopes is that folks that are listening to this right now, you can take this interview, take the link, and tweet it to all of these corporate rappers that you may or may not be supporting. Tweet it to them, post it on their Facebook pages, and tell them to listen. Because, you know, some of those brothers and sisters may not realize, some may realize, and some may just be capitalist, you know, strumpets, you know, and may be enjoying, you know, making themselves look like a fool, you know, like a monkey for white corporations. Maybe some, you know, the money is worth that. But others, you know, I'm convinced, have no idea. And it takes us, a community, us, those of you that are listening right now, as much as Tim or myself, it's not just myself, we all have something to learn from each other, those of us that are in these liberation struggles. But, you know, when we learn something new from somebody like a Norman Richmond, when you get something from a show like Your World News, take that and spread it to those that need it the most. I mean, spread it to everybody, but definitely spread it to those that need it the most, because there may be that light there that is used to ignite, you know, a flame within them, to charge them to stop doing some of the mentally and physically destructive things that they're doing, and to have an about face and to press forward ever, backward never, as Kwame Nkrumah said, and to start being a part of something bigger than themselves, something that can make this world a much, much, much better place. So, Tim, what are your final thoughts?
I just couldn't agree more that, you know, the information is really where the power lies. And with that information can prepare you to action, you know, and actions are things that change things. So I couldn't agree more.
And what did you think about, you know, what are some of the things that you picked up from the interview?
Well, it was just great to see and put in perspective how, you know, music is just another one of those playing fields where white supremacy has caused basically the co-opting of African music, and how white supremacy really tries to infiltrate every single aspect of resistance, whether it's music, you know, economics, the criminal justice system or injustice system, the medical system, on every single front, white supremacy is trying to attack African resistance. And I think it was great to see how this interview really brought out how that's happening in the front of music as well.
Thank you. And so without further ado, I think we have the perfect song to end this episode with. And this is Dead Prez, Game is a Battlefield. I think this is the best. This is like, you know, one of the best songs I can think of that would be befitting this episode. And so this is dedicated to Norman Richmond. It's dedicated to all the freedom fighters who are home with their ancestors and are fighting to this day. You know, continue to use music as a tool. Without a doubt, Madiba, Nelson Mandela. As we know, Madiba was his, you know, was his clan name. You know, was inspired by music. Certainly was inspired by music, and so and I think all freedom fighters, in some shape, form, or fashion, are inspired by music or the arts in general. So here is Dead Prez, Game is a Battlefield. Until next time, I'm Solomon Kamajan for Tim Bodiff Lynchin. This is Your World News. Journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive.
This is a mockery of your number one station that's brainwashing the nation. Playing the same old stereotypical musical as usual. With no balance or substance, cause you motherfuckers love it.
They scared of real hip-hop, like the threat of war. The game is a battlefield, but it's not a metaphor, it's real life. You get drafted by the A&Rs, you get sworn in and join in to play your part. Like a soldier, with no choice, you are what they say you are. They use your voice to wage a war. They send you across lands and over airways. The video program is like an air raid. Women and children in the line of fire. Today rappers is like mercenaries, soldiers for hire, dog tags and gold chains, slugs is raps killing brown and blacks, like campaigns in Iraq, minefields in the whack. If it don't blow up, you get a bayonet in your back. Back on the block like a vet in the wheelchair, no health care. The same way the rap gang did the first pioneers, it's a battlefield.
WRBG, it's a takeover, not a makeover.
The word is the bullet. Peter Tosh had an AK for a guitar. I'm Che, but my pen is my cigar. Urban Gorilla Griot, other side of the peephole. It's the war outside. I say Fleo, Leo, Smeo, is it real? Audio terror, this ain't a drill. Now your helmet is a new era. Fashionista army apparel. Gun barrel, radio waves. Rapid return fire. Street call desire. It's the fall of the empire. Download your freedom using hi-fi, Wi-Fi. Spy verse spy. It's the media lie. Identify yourself, soldier. We ain't making classics no more. We getting over. Keep looking over your shoulder. Study the terrain. See, they watching the internet. They're studying your brain. And politics is war without guns. I said it before. Now they turn the battlefield into a dance floor, and it's hard to the core. If you start to explore, it's hard to the core. If you start to explore.
System to see if you motherfuckers are really listening. This would have never been really played on the radio. It's a takeover.